All right, welcome back to Sloydcast. I'm your host, Mark Angelini, and I'm joined by my co-host, Mike Hanna, as well as our first in-studio guest, Zach Christinger. And this
AKA
is
AKA Zach, or AKA Chris.
And this is our second go. We were just 18 minutes into our recording before we realized we had a technical issue. Which, if you've been following along, it's nothing new for our journey as podcasters. But there's some special quirks when you try to record three people in person.
That's right.
So without any further ado, we're joined by Zach. And now he's got his story down really good because he already told it once.
He rehearsed it once.
But Zach, can you tell the listeners where you are from and what you do and just give us a little rundown about your life?
Yeah, so yeah, I grew up here in Virginia, and have lived here pretty much my entire life. I grew up in a small town called Warrenton, northern end of Virginia. Went to college in Southern Virginia, and then have been living right outside of the Charlottesville area for about the last 5 or 6 years. About 3 years ago, I decided to move up to Midcoast, Maine, and started my woodworking journey a little bit more seriously there. Area with a really rich history of handcraft. Yeah, a lot of really amazing folks doing.
Now, when you say Midcoast, Maine, I picture the ocean for sure, and maybe a bunch of rocks, but what's the general area in Midcoast Maine that, when you say that, what do you mean exactly?
Yeah, like a lot of rocky coastline. The area in particular where I live is a little bit more than an hour north of Portland.
Okay.
Nice.
Yeah.
Yeah, a lot of rocky coastline. There's some sandy beaches.
Oh, really?
Started surfing when I got to Maine.
That's cool.
Being on the coast feels really special.
Yeah, I bet.
Yeah. Nice.
Sweet, man.
So we were talking on our first first go through about Zach's journey into green woodworking and Sloyd. And I was just asking him, you know, what was really the first thing that got you into green woodworking, and in particular to the pole lathe learning, which is kind of your primary focus now?
Initially I started working as a carpenter right after college. I was brought onto this really unique environment where we're building a house for a farm owner. You know, working with a lot of really incredible local woods and materials. Coming into that job with zero woodworking or carpentry experience, you know, I was the guy cleaning up and sanding
lots of sanding.
And kind of gradually was given a little bit more framing and trim windows and doors. Mostly was working, you know, underneath. That kind of got the gears turning as far as working with my hands.
Nice.
So, you know, we always had cool little cutoffs from, you know, pieces of black walnut or cherry that we've been using in the job. And I take those home and sand them down and make little cutting boards or coat racks. Stools, just really simple.
And were you using power tools to do those types of projects?
Yeah, okay. Yeah. And again, a lot of sanding.
Yeah.
I was really good at that from that job. Also working with soapstone, which is a local resource in that area.
You said, what was the town that has the largest soapstone quarry in the world?
It's called Schuyler.
Schuyler.
Yeah.
I had never heard of that.
I think the quarry is owned by a Canadian company.
Oh. Interesting. Huh.
Mm. Yeah, they cut out the stone and then ship it very far away.
And what do they, just as a side too, what are they using, like in the project you were on, what was the soapstone used for primarily?
We were inlaying it around fireplace.
Okay, because that's where I've heard it is, like wood stoves, fireplaces, that type of stuff.
That's neat.
Soapstone's a really incredible material. Cooking on it is a relatively common thing.
Yeah.
Kind of works as similar to like the surface of a cast iron.
Okay.
Yeah.
Have a porous surface and well oiled, you have like a nonstick.
Okay.
Oh, neat.
Yeah, I've seen wood stoves that have soapstone built into the surface for cooking.
That's neat.
Because it holds heat well too, right?
Yeah, I mean, it can be hours after your fire has gone out.
Cool.
Yeah, definitely started experimenting with soapstone as well. And I kind of started messing around with making soapstone furniture. Little end tables and stools.
Yeah.
And because soapstone is so soft, you know, it's easy to sand. Mm. You can get a diamond blade for a skill saw and cut and shape it. So I started creating these stools where I drill holes through the soapstone and attach wooden legs with dowels. They usually had three or four legs and then would attach them together with like a shelf.
Mm. Nice.
Yeah, I really enjoyed making the project where I felt like I was creating something organically, maybe not necessarily based off of something that I'd seen online.
Mm-hmm.
Although I'm sure other people
yeah.
tried it.
Yeah.
You know, I can't be the only one.
So you were just, the materials were there and you just got to tinkering around. And...
Yeah. I mean, it was just being around like those beautiful materials, it just felt hard to not do anything.
Yeah. Yeah.
I felt like I was in like a really unique and lucky position and I should try to take advantage.
Yeah, absolutely.
Nice.
So then you were telling us on this project, the serendipity of, I guess it was a friend who had some pole lathe tools and he asked you if you'd ever heard of pole lathe turning.
Yeah. which I surely hadn't. I'd done some pole turning on electric lathe. I really enjoyed
that.
But as I was mentioning earlier, you know, I've been doing so much power tools. I felt like I'd reached my quota of of hours of being in like a dusty and loud environment. So, yeah, I was really searching for something that felt a little bit more environmentally
Mm-hmm.
Nice.
Yeah, you know, after explaining these feelings to a friend, he Ben Orford hooks and well, yeah, I looked into it and like, yeah, that's really neat. I'd love to try a pole lathe myself. So from there, just I used Owen Thomas's videos on YouTube for. Yeah, really incredible resource. And I think at the time he hadn't posted, they hadn't been up online for all that long. So like, this is just like, you know, meant to be in some
way.
Yeah. You know,
yeah.
Like this like step-by-step tutorial of how to make your own. And my brother had an Alaskan chainsaw mill. He had just milled up some ash from land that my grandfather had owned.
Mm.
Perfect.
Yeah.
Tools and just need to get it built.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, once the lathe was complete, you know, I hadn't really looked too far ahead. So I realized I need to make a mandrel and I need to handle my tools and learn how to make bowl blanks. So, you know, I had so much energy and excitement to like get going. And yeah, I mean, once I finally got to that point, I was just like obsessed with turning.
Mm. Yeah. I can relate to that. The first winter I built my pole lathe, I literally, like, every day when I was done working, I would just try and turn at least one bowl. And I think I turned, like, I don't know, I probably turned like 20 bowls in a month. Just at night. I would just like go in there. And
pretty cool.
It's very addicting.
It's very, very, very addicting. Yeah.
Especially when you're learning, because there's every time you turn, you learn one more little thing.
Yeah.
And so then you want to do it again to push that a little further.
Yeah.
It's very exhilarating.
Species of wood that you're turning. Right. Like, oh, this is a totally different thing.
Yep.
Exactly.
Yep. That's exactly right. Yeah. Or even moisture too, just from one same species when you have different moisture levels in that wood. Yeah.
3 Fathoms and Ben Orford's tutorials on how to turn.
Yep.
And where I was living, I had really poor service. So I'd run up the hill and like watch a couple minutes and then sprint back down. That's and awesome. Like got it. And it was just kind of this vicious cycle.
That's awesome.
But it was, you know.
It worked.
Yeah, it worked. And like, you know, I think having that energy towards trying something new.
Oh, yeah. So fun. We were also expanding on how I think it's cool that the way you went about pole lathe turning was just kind of like jump in 2 feet first. Yeah. Cause I think it's easy. It's the kind of thing where this is my experience, at least. Like I learned about it and I watched all these videos, seen how to do all of it online, but there was still like a hurdle of, you know, having to actually go ahead and do it. And so I ended up waiting and taking a course. But there's just something to be said about just jump into it. That's kind of how I got into spoon carving. It was just like, I didn't know what I was doing. I just, I need an axe. Okay, here's an axe. I need a knife. I better get a knife. And, you know, one thing led to another. And I think that's really fun because you just, you know, there's no real preconceived notions as to like what you should do or how to do it. And so obviously it's harder, but I think it's a little more of a rich experience, I would say.
Certainly. Yeah.
Yeah.
I linked up with a guy named Nathan Jenkins who lives up in Page County in Virginia and pole lathe turning for probably 20 years.
Is this the guy you told me about?
Yeah.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah, the Bodging Bigfoot. Yeah. I asked him if I could come and do a day of turning with him. He said, yeah, come on by. And I was kind of expecting it to be this lesson and giving me all these tips. And, you know, I started turning and like, I didn't feel like I was doing a good job. And, you know, he just said to me, he's like, there are a lot of ways to go about doing this.
Yeah.
And yeah, that's really stuck with me because it's so true. And, you know, I think like having this expectation of turning something. It's really unrealistic.
Absolutely. I find that pole turning is so unique to the individual. That's why I think I like it so much, because like, you know, for example, I used hooks from Adrian Lloyd when I first got started, and over time I'm like, you know, I really like these hooks, but once I started forging my own and like knowing how the edge geometry work and the way I turned my form, I was like, my hooks ended up being drastically different than the way Adrian Lloyd's was, you know, forging his hooks. So like it's so unique to the individual, and like you said, there's so much individuality involved in pole lathe turning. I think it's such a rich and value filled environment to grow in, and I think that's why, even though I wasn't really planning on it when I first got started, I watched Mark turn and I watched a bunch of YouTube videos. I just got going on my own and just learned as I went, and I was like, oh, this is kind of neat. There's so much more to it than going and taking a class and like learning from someone else, than just picking up the craft on your own and experimenting over time.
I think that's one of the beautiful things about pole lathe turning too, is it is, I mean, spoon carving, yeah, to some extent, but pole lathe is so much different because you have to build your own lathe. You got to build your own, I mean, generally, obviously you can buy tools now and buy centers, but when you're doing all that, like you're building it for yourself and you get really used to your setup. Like I remember last year we had our little solstice gathering and Mike and I built this lathe a few years back, and I've never been able to get that lathe to work as well as mine in my shop does. And it's just everything. I'm just so used to that, or I just built it perfectly for myself. Probably a little bit of both, but I think there's very few, at least in woodworking, there's very few things like that. Cause you know, power tools, you got whatever brand of power tool, you got, you know, whatever tool from whatever maker. And so there's very little individuality at that level.
Yep.
Which I think is one of the coolest things about pole lathe turning and obviously like the broader handcraft woodworking in general is it's so personalized to your way of working. You know, everything about it is dialed in for you.
Yeah. Even the style of bowls. Like I can tell, now that I know you guys, I can tell a Mark's bowl from a Chris bowl, you know, like, or Zach's bowl, right? My own bowl. And it's just, even if I see like a Jared bowl, a Jared Dow bowl, or, you know, Sharif Adam or some of the other big bowl turners, you're like, you can tell just from the style, like, oh, I know where that, like, I know who turns that.
Yeah.
So just the style and the that final form. Like, I think after a while, from turning, you just kind of develop that, just that form that really works for you, that you really enjoy turning. And it's so individual and unique to you and how you like to work on a lathe.
Yeah, that was kind of a unique part about, you know, the progression of getting better at turning. Yeah, and I think...
Now, did you have any... Like, had you seen a bowl and you're like, I want to turn that bowl? Or was it just... The piece of wood was in front of you and it just sort of took shape.
Right, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, and, you know, I think, yeah, starting out, I just had this, like, little, like, plumber's hatchet.
Yeah.
Incredibly dull. But it was, like, so my bowl blanks were these really rough, irregular pieces of wood.
And so you had a lot of wood to remove.
Yeah, so the shape was whatever I could make, you know.
Yeah.
It wasn't really, I wasn't going for anything.
Okay, that's so interesting.
Bowl-like.
Yeah,
bowl-like.
It just had to be hollow on the inside.
Yeah. Or a little bit of water.
Yeah. It could be 2 inches thick, but it's as long as it has some sort of, you know, hollow, I'm good to go.
That's cool. Because that's, you know, we can get into this discussion, but that's one of the interesting things about the internet that it's kind of like a double-edged sword for me. Like, there's so much inspiration, but at some point, it almost, like, can corrupt your mind in a way because...
Yeah.
That for me, that's how, maybe it's probably my genetics more than anything, but I'm just like, everything's so, that Scandinavian aesthetic for me, which it probably is my heritage, but I just like can't get it out of my head. And when I go and make whatever it is, like it's just, I have to try to not go in that direction. Mm-hmm. And that's how it very much was when I got into pole lathe turning. Like I just had this image of this bowl I wanted to turn, you know, and I was just always chasing that image. Instead of kind of letting it, you know,
that's a great point.
Organically develop.
That's a great point that you make, Mark. I think a lot of us makers, and Instagram is, you know, good and bad. We go on there and you're like, oh, I love that spoon and the way it looks. I want to do the same.
Yeah.
Or I love that bowl and the way, or I love that knife and I want to do the same. And I think we get stuck in these phases where we fixate on that shape and we're constantly chasing it instead of like, oh, let's just do what we want to do and like. See what comes out of our uniqueness and individuality rather than like chasing after
an image I saw
online, you know?
It's tough because it's a flood of inspiration.
It is.
It's almost too much.
And especially for new makers, I think they get overwhelmed sometimes by just the perfection, right? Quote unquote perfection of what something looks like aesthetically. It's like, I want that. I want to do the same thing. It's like, one day.
Yeah, I definitely have feelings of envy.
Yes.
Readily available thing.
Yeah.
It's like, you know, how differently your mind would function, especially in a creative setting.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
What feels good to you.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, certainly we're always basing shapes and things off of naturally found things.
Yeah,
like you said, the internet, it's just like this overload.
The flood.
Yeah.
that's such an important thing to note. I think just the how creativity has evolved over the years with, you know, with having access to the internet or books or magazines and things like that, where the average person like living in Appalachia, like back in the day, they didn't have access to that. Like, my wife needs a spatula. I got to go out and make one. Let me grab this like piece of white oak that's been sitting out in the firewood pile. And just make a spatula. They had nothing to go off of other than their own sense of creativity and like,
or what the purpose of it was.
Yeah. Right. Like this was totally like a functional item that I need to use around the homestead instead of like, I'm going to go to the market down the road and sell it or post a picture of it on Instagram. So like that creativity has changed so much over time, and it's gotten to a place where someone's already done it, or you're just modifying someone else's shape, yeah. You know, based on how you're trying to make it. So, yeah, it's kind of sad.
It's a double-edged sword.
It is. Yeah, it is.
Sure.
Yeah.
So yeah, I just think that part's so cool that you're like, you also mentioned earlier on our unrecorded interview, how you got into all this during the COVID stuff, and you were kind of like in this, you said it was just a really special time because you were just like out in the woods with the pole lathe, small group of people, and so you were just kind of in the zone. Almost when you were describing it, it sounded kind of like tribal to me.
Yeah, it felt that way. It was a very, very simple time. I think I really discovered things.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and like I was saying earlier, it's like there's part of me that's like always chasing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I can relate to that. Especially yeah. Having kids and it's crazy how much that just that one thing can change your whole
Absolutely.
Trajectory of life. And you like I just recently been reflecting back on times in my 20s and just thinking about like real simple times like that where
yeah
man
all you had to worry about was yourself.
Yeah, what a different
yeah
what a different advantage.
Yeah.
So you were living at a farm, you said you had a lot of, you know, basically like infinite access to materials and I don't know where I'm going with that question. But I'm sure that fed into your obsession, progression, however you want to word it, is because you were just in, like you were kind of disconnected, but you're connected to the source of the materials and inspiration.
Right.
So you were able to just pretty much, were you still working on the house build at that point, or did
no,
you kind of transition into just full-on pole lathe?
Full-on pole lathe, yeah. Which, you know, there's good and bad to that. You know, I think right off the bat, I did have this sense of, like, needing to
make money. Right.
I think certainly can bring in some negative feelings.
Yeah.
Yes. There's a, you know, yes. There's an element of pressure behind it. Like, having, like, yeah, I have to make this much.
Right.
Bowls this week to hope to sell them.
Yeah.
You know, not always working out.
Mm.
You know, I was fortunate that at that time I was living as simply as possible. So, you know, I was doing a work trade for my housing, dumpster diving a lot
nice.
For my food, which I love to do. And just trying to cut down on as many costs as possible.
Awesome.
There was a little bit of pressure, but I didn't have big bills to pay.
Right.
Yeah.
Which was really nice and allowed me that freedom to have that time.
Nice.
Which I was really, really
good.
Yeah.
And that was about, you said that was about like a year long that you kind of got into the pole lathe turning and really honed it over about a season.
Yeah. Yeah. And then there's a lot of practice that year.
Yeah.
But I loved it. Never really felt like work. I was really satisfied with the work that I was doing. And I remember I started a little drying shelf in my room for my bowls. And about a month or two of being into it, like walking up to my room, and it was just full of bowls drying. And I was like, yeah, that's just like a deep sense of satisfaction. Of wow, like, getting better at this.
Mm-hmm. And you were selling everything you were making pretty much?
Yeah. I created a website and then had started tapping local farmers markets.
Nice. You know,
having a website and not having about it, you know, it was kind of useless.
Yeah.
Yeah.
doing the farmers markets was really enjoyable.
Mm.
I'd bring my lathe with me to markets and demonstrate, because I think, you know, oftentimes people, you just see a wooden bowl, it's just a wooden bowl.
Yeah.
Right.
Being able to see how it's made and getting to connect.
Mm-hmm.
That's a different experience.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Then there's like a memory attached to that bowl when they buy it. Oh, this guy was turning it with his foot.
I think that's so true, to the degree that I think a lot of people spend the money and buy the item because they want to know the story behind it. Like, I mean, like what makes this bowl different from this bowl, right? So the story behind the item, I think sometimes is what really is one of the biggest marketing things you could you can provide for the customer, because they're like, whoa, you're doing this just with your own foot and hand, and there's like no power involved. And once they see that process, I think they fall in love so much more with the item, because they can know like what went into making it, you know.
That's a big piece of marketing too. Yeah. Something I've constantly been learning, because I've been working for myself for going on 15 years now, and it's a challenging thing, because you like marketing seems like this super sterile like corporate word, but it's not. It's actually a very human thing where we, especially now with Instagram, I mean, most people buy things for an emotional drive. It's not so much like the product necessarily. It's you know, a lot of I think a lot of it is just like, oh, I like that. I think for a lot of people, actually, with when it comes to green woodworking or like farming or anything that's related to land or a simpler quote unquote way of living.
Yeah.
I think a lot of times people are trying to buy a piece of that because they lack that to some extent, which is why there's probably so many knife makers that sell knives to people who live in cities, because it's like they want to be a part of, they want to have that part of their life, you know, which they might find to be lacking in their existence if they live in a city or whatever it might be.
Right.
So it is marketing is definitely a big part of, you know, getting someone to buy into your story, I guess, for lack of a better way of putting it.
Yeah.
So having the pole laid there, we've seen that doing markets ourselves. You know, if you're carving a spoon or you turn a bowl, it draws people in. They want to see it. They've never seen that before, and increases the likelihood that they'll buy something. In my experience,
it's definitely a huge attraction. And the more you, and I think that's where Instagram is really good, where you can share your process, right? Not rather than you just make post pictures of products. And I think when you share your product, you share your process, it draws so much more attention to what you're doing. And I think it's that emotional connection that people have with your process that gets them to the buying of the item.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, and I think a lot of people don't capitalize on that marketing, you know, technique, if you want to call it like that. I mean, I think it's a great thing. But it does make it more human. Like, there's just such a human connection to that. And that, I think, just makes it more than just, oh, I'm going through a store looking at the shelf and I see this item and I want to buy it.
And then whatever the packaging or the logo. Or
right. And some kid and whoever
somebody
knows.
Somebody smiling.
Yeah.
Oh, they're happy. I'm going to buy them.
Right,
I want to be happy too.
Some kid in India or China, like, you know, was making clothing or whatever it is. So,
speaking of, while we're on the topic of social media, you've had quite a successful ride using social media, it seems like. I know you're, you know, in terms of like the metrics, your followers account has gone up significantly since you've been on there. I'm curious how that's played into your path as you've used social media. How has that influenced, you know, what you've decided to do? I know you're doing a lot of classes, so it probably helps in that regard to get the word out.
Yeah, no, it certainly has. And, you know, I try to look at it in a positive.
Yeah.
I have a lot of conflicting feelings.
Sure.
I feel like in the last year or so, I've gained a following, which has been great for getting the word out for classes and just like the pulley turning. I mean, in regards to like sales and my own stuff, you know, it really, there was like a little tick, but it didn't change things.
Really? I've heard that a couple of times.
Yeah, and then that was kind of a surprising experience, but it also, you know, really let me know that, like, you know, this isn't, I shouldn't just rely on Instagram as my only tool.
Yeah.
You know, I know I've heard Emmett mention this before, email.
Yeah. Right.
That are like committed.
Yeah, to
following what you have to offer.
Yeah,
because a follow on Instagram is, you know, all you're doing is tapping a button, so it's like there's no investment at all.
Yes,
and you can easily unfollow.
certainly.
That's so interesting. Yeah, I was curious about that because I think Emmett, when we talked to him, he did mention something about some people he's tied into in the craft world that have gotten these huge followings and it hasn't translated to increased, you know, success with their business side of it, which is always interesting. But you have, you do have wider reach. Theoretically, I guess.
Yeah. Well, I think part of it is a lot of people just get a really a nice kick of dopamine just watching something.
Yeah.
Or just like seeing that picture of the item. It's like, oh, that's cool. Right? So now check this out. It's cool, right?
And you were doing a lot of videos. Is that, you think that's what led to the rise of your following?
Yeah, I guess so. Mm-hmm. You know, in a lot of ways, I just feel like I lucked out. And somehow my video got put into the right algorithm.
Right.
Yeah.
I feel like I was doing anything special.
Yeah. Yeah. You weren't like strategizing, like, how do I grow my follower count?
Yeah. I mean, I try to, I try to keep my effort towards Instagram.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But, you know, also trying to acknowledge and understand that it is a tool.
Yeah.
And it can be used for positive things.
Yeah, for sure. I'm curious to hear about your transition from, like, you know, as you started off pole lathe turning and really honing in your skills and figuring out the forms you wanted to chase. And then from going to local markets and demonstrating there and just having that aspect of showing the process and how people connected to it and purchase your items. How did you transition from that to then like wanting to teach and knowing like there's now a much bigger market where you could make more money, you could, you know, have something a little more that you could provide for the community so then they can get into it and learn a skill? Because that's, at least for me, that's how I felt about like selling spoons or making knives or turning bowls. I'm like, man, it's really hard going to markets and doing all this legwork and trying to, and you know, feeling disappointed in the end if people didn't buy your thing, right?
Sure.
It's like, how can I get access to a world where I could teach and share the skill, and at the same time, if they like my things, they can buy them. So there's just it's like an untapped world of things that you could do that would really help, you know, give back a little bit financially if you're putting in a lot of work. So I'm curious to hear about a story about how you transitioned from that to teaching.
Yeah, and I think that's like the really tough part, especially being a craftsperson, is like you can't just rely on one thing.
Yeah.
You have to diversify. And I think I really got that on doing markets, because you know, I was able to make, you know, a little bit of money doing them, but production work was just constant.
Yeah.
And, I think after a couple of years of doing that, body fighting back a little bit.
Yeah.
And yeah, you know, like it there are great parts to being at a market. At the end of the day, you're standing behind the table with things that you've, you know, put your hard work into.
Right.
And be a little soul sucking just having.
Yeah.
Buy my stuff.
Right. Yeah, it's like, I don't want to have to beg somebody to buy a bowl, and I'm not going to do that.
Right.
You know, if it's right for them, great.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm happy to like share what I'm doing, but I don't want to have to convince somebody to buy.
Certainly.
Come and get your bowls. Bowl-laid turn bowls.
On sale now, $50.
Yeah, that's, I've experienced that myself.
Yes.
Yeah. It's interesting, you know, being in the farming world, we have some good friends that they quit doing farmers markets, not for that exact reason, but for the grind of the farmers market is what. So you don't really see that. You see someone sad at the market, it's like, oh, this is so nice, but there's so much that goes into that. One day is like 3 days almost, because there's so much. Especially being a craftsperson, you have to make all that stuff, prepare it, get it all ready for sale. So there's all that time investment. Then you're getting ready,
right?
Your display, your tent, your whatever it is.
Hope it doesn't rain.
Yeah.
And there's a lot hinging on this one time frame, and like the weather, what's going on elsewhere in that town, all of that could dictate how well your sales go.
Yeah, they're really hit or miss, and there's so, like you said, there's so much work that goes into them. And for a craft person, like you could spend a whole season turning or carving or forging or whatever it is. And it's like, oh, I get to do 2 or 3 markets a year. And let's hope I sell all the stuff I just made and spent all this time on.
So you transition more into the teaching and now you sell stuff online as well.
Correct. Yeah. So yeah, I had done, I'd done a few classes. Yeah, I was thinking about that on the drive down here. The very first class that I did, I was teaching lathe turning, how to make a stool and spoon carving. And like,
wow,
was,
in one class.
In one class. Oh my God. Just like, which was crazy.
How did that go? Like,
it was hectic.
I bet.
Trying to bounce around and like having everybody doing something
different.
Wow.
Yeah, that, I mean, it was a great experience because I think it really made me realize how much I enjoyed the connection part.
Mm. Yeah.
But it was also like, I need to rethink how I want to go about doing this.
Yeah.
Yeah, and then last summer, I built 4 more lathes. The real goal of like focusing on teaching pole lathe turning.
Yeah.
Bought a small little trailer for my truck that is just big enough to fit.
That's awesome.
To fit 5 lathes into.
Yeah.
And from I'm really glad I made that decision because I think the solitude of working alone every day was really starting to wear on me.
Yeah.
I don't like to think of myself as a social person. Mm-hmm. I do like time alone, yeah. But I think at the end of the day, as humans, like we're made to connect.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely.
You know, and I think spending like a full day with strangers.
Yeah.
Really great experience.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
You know, getting to hear about their lives and, you know, stories about, you know, and this like reminds them, like the smells and the tools remind them of their grandparent or even people with like who've never picked up a knife or never carved or done any type of handwork, just trying something that's like so out of their comfort zone.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's like I think watching somebody throughout the day and seeing this experience become really empowering for them. Mm. You know, turning your first bowl is not easy by any means.
No, it's
not. Even if you have somebody there to kind of help you through the process.
Right.
But, you know, everybody's able to finish.
Yeah.
And everybody goes home with something that they made.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a really special thing to watch.
Yeah, sure. I bet. That's fun. So how many classes have you been doing? When did you start focusing more on teaching?
Probably last fall. So
okay.
I was in Virginia for the summer and then went up to Maine August through December. Really started to host a few more classes there.
Okay.
Maine in particular, there seems like there's a lot of interest in the local community.
Yeah. Yeah.
I was fortunate enough that I got linked up with Kenneth and Angela Quartermeyer at the Maine Coast Craft School.
Nice.
They gave me permission to stay on their land for my time. They were just wrapping up their teaching season. Just being around people who are very craft community and like their life really embodies craft in a lot of ways.
Mm-hmm.
That was a really amazing experience.
Yeah.
One thing that's been resonating through my mind a lot recently is just surround yourself with, and I think that was like, that was a really great lesson of like putting myself in situations where I know I'm going to be exposed to good teachers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's awesome.
They say you become like the 5 people you spend the most time with. So,
well, it's like kind of like what your parents tell you. Like kids, like the people you hang out with have an influence. And,
yeah, absolutely.
I think as a kid, you're like, well, whatever. But yeah. It's so true, you know?
Yeah.
Look at me. I hang out with this guy.
Look at you now. You hang out with us.
No, it is very, it's so true. When you're a kid, especially, you're super easily influenced.
Yeah.
That's cool. Yeah. See, I wouldn't say we really have that going on in this exact area. The kind of craft community is pretty.
Yeah. Unfortunately, we don't.
Pretty dispersed. But it does seem like up there, there's like a pretty good concentration. Minnesota, Wisconsin,
Vermont.
Vermont.
Hampshire,
yeah.
Western Mass.
Couple hotbeds, I guess, North Carolina. One thing, I don't know if you saw this to be true, but because, you know, I have only lived here for going on 7 years now, but my experience trying to sell stuff in the Detroit area was I do different types of markets and I would always have, I wouldn't say like a hard time selling stuff, but it was, the sale was always a little bit more work.
Mm.
talking a lot to get one sale.
Yeah.
Whereas here, I came down here and did my first market and I pretty much sold everything.
Yeah.
And it was like, there was no question on prices. It was like, oh, I want this. Yeah. And it was just such a radically different experience. And that's pretty much held true to the, for the most part, you know, I've done a couple different types of markets around the area here. And I don't know what it is, if it's like socioeconomic or if it's just a cultural thing, but it seemed like people here were more readily willing to support someone that made something.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas in Michigan, maybe it's that kind of post-industrial mindset. He's like factory worker. I don't know. Yeah. I try to wrap my head around what the difference is, but I don't know if you've experienced that to any extent. No, I never have done farmers markets. I've always done like a specific maker's market. So it's like people came, they knew they're going to buy something from somebody generally. So I haven't been in a farmer's market where it's like someone's going to get a loaf of bread and they're like, oh, you got bowls? Well, I don't need a bowl today. Maybe next week I'll check one out.
I need to buy food.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like with farmer's markets, people are usually doing their
grocery. Right.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah, oh, that's very good point. Christmas shopping is a little different. People are ready to, that's probably what it is, actually.
Yeah.
I do it during Christmas time and everyone's like, oh, I got to get a gift for this person.
Yeah.
So maybe that's the variable I forgot to consider.
That's true.
But do you find that people had, I don't know, I guess what's your take on that with?
Yeah, I mean,
have you ever done just a craft focused market before?
No.
Okay, it's always been farmer's market. Okay. Yeah, so that makes sense. It's a little bit different demographic and, you know, farmers markets in general are kind of funny places too. I've worked a bunch of them and even trying to sell food, sometimes it's like, you know, it depends on the market, but there's certain farmers markets where it's like people don't go there to really buy food. They go there to buy like some cookies and like a jar of jam or something. And it's like, they're not going and buying bushels of food.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, I'll go to the farmers market and buy a little, you know, whatever, marshmallow. I don't know. It's like some random.
That's very
cupcake
true.
Or
that's very
it's
true.
Not even a it's not even like a, you know,
they go to the grocery store to get their groceries.
But different, you know, some farmers markets aren't like that, but
right.
I know a lot are, so maybe that plays into it as well. Generally that demographic's not really trying to spend that much money in general, whether it's a bowl or a food item. What's your experience been focusing more on the online sales? Do you feel like it's a little bit more targeted because it's like you're putting yourself out there on the internet and then someone's like, oh, I want to buy one of Zach's bowls, so then they go to your website.
Right. It's definitely more simple.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, yeah, just putting something out there. If somebody likes it, they can just click.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which, you know, which is easy for me and I appreciate that and on a lot of levels, but there's also a real joy talking to somebody who's going to purchase something.
I agree.
Yeah.
Really getting to tell them, like, how the bowl is made.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right. There's more connection there for sure.
Now, I'm curious, just from, like, the geeky side, what platform do you use to sell your stuff online?
Like as far as websites?
Yeah, yeah.
I use Big Cartel.
Okay.
I think I was looking at Owen Thomas's and Yoav's website, and they use Big Cartel. I really like the layout. It's like super
very easy,
very, very simple.
Yeah.
Like uploading your products is like
okay.
Oh, cool. Big Cartel sounds bad, but I'm gonna try it.
Yeah, I know.
sounds bad. I'll give it a shot. What are you exactly selling me here?
This is a funny
Big
name,
Cartel.
Right? I'm just curious because that's. I do, you know, I dabble a lot on the back end side and I've always done like weird, I've always been more obscure when I use like online sale type stuff. And I know there's a lot of turnkey stuff like Squarespace, Big Cartel. There's another big one that people use for like drop shipping stuff.
Where do you go from here, man? What's your next move right now? I know you said you had some other projects you're working on. You're building a tiny house and
tiny house.
You're trying to split your time between Maine and Virginia. What's next for you?
Yeah, you know, just trying to, you know, I guess for the last couple of years, I've been bouncing around a lot. And yeah, housing has been a really big obstacle, especially in regards to being in Maine.
The winter.
Oh, yeah. And like, you know, finding a area or community where you really like, but it only being a temporary.
Right.
Yeah, I think that's kind of the downside of like doing work.
Sure. Yeah.
So yeah, my partner and I are building a tiny house on a trailer. Yeah, it's just been a really fun and a big time consuming project, but yeah, it doesn't feel like work, you know. It's really nice being able to apply, you know, skills in carpentry that I've learned over the years, shaping this house or structure that I'm going to get to actually live in and interact with. So yeah, that's kind of got me tied to being in Virginia right now. The hope is to take it up to Maine.
Nice.
Yeah, okay.
That's cool, man.
Yeah, I think at the end of the day, just ready to feel a little bit more settled.
Yeah.
You know, in Virginia, just be returning to the same place.
Right.
Met a lot of really great folks up there. Enjoy my time up there.
Yeah.
Love to, keep on with those.
That's awesome. Yeah. There was one aspect of pole lathing turning we didn't talk about, which is, you know, near and dear to my heart, and that's forging the hooks. Tell us about that process. Like, I know you said you had some hooks that you purchased from Ben, from a friend who had purchased them from Ben. And then how did you transition from that to then realizing that, man, if I want to keep this up, I got to start making my own, because buying those tools is not cheap.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, and you know, you notice your tools start to wear down over time. And these are not going to last.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, the set that I had from Ben, I mean, those served me really well. I still have one of his hooks, which is this kind of unique, like double bevel.
Oh, yeah. You've made a few of those, didn't
you? Yeah.
Mark did. Yeah.
They're great. They're super versatile. Mm-hmm. I mean, you can do all sorts of cuts.
Yeah. I love those. I have one of those I use for when I'm doing plates for making the flat of the plate, and I do the bevel up.
Nice.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I bought one of the tools. I got a Yoav tool. It was a tip down.
Oh yeah.
Loved. I made the mistake of kind of using some of my personal tools in class.
Oh yeah.
And I had one break on me. That was a sad day.
Yeah,
but learning how to make your own really kind of brings a full circle understanding of like what it is you're actually doing and how this edge is interacting with the wood.
Yeah.
That was one thing I was really in admiration of other pole lathe turners that, you know, when I was first started. Robin Wood and Sharif.
Yeah.
Their understanding of whole process,
sure,
through and through, from, you know, building your lathe to axing out a bowl blank. It's just like, you know, if any part of that system fails, there's like a knowledge to know how to fix it.
Absolutely.
It's not like the end of your day. It's like, okay, right. I guess I'm making a tool.
Right. Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, forging's still a pretty new thing to me. Make hooks that function, but I still have yet to have that really good comprehension of specifically like what I need out of the hook, and how to get it shaped to that point. I have a pretty crude blacksmithing setup right now, but it does the job. Old railroad tie anvil, and use a little angle grinder to grind my bevel. I love that. You know, I love working
simple.
Yeah, that's awesome.
What do you use for sharpening your tools? I'm curious, because that's something that's not often discussed.
I use the DMT hone.
Yeah.
Little metal plate.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's like coarse fine, ultra fine.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Those have served me really, really well.
And then you have one of the tapered cones.
Yeah.
Nice. That's exactly what I use.
Yeah, and that works really well. And I've really adopted Sharif's method of, instead of sharpening towards the bevel, you hold the cone flat and then kind of rub it on the entire flat backside.
Mm-hmm.
And that really helps keep the back edge of the tool consistent.
Flat.
Yeah.
Sure,
the, you know, human error is a...
Yeah.
Yep. Yeah.
Will change.
Oh, yeah.
Time.
Yeah, I learned that the hard way too, is I just sharpen the bevel side and then knock the burr off on the flat and try to keep that as flat as possible. Because once you start getting, what would you call it, Mike? When the backside of your hook.
Where you start rounding.
When
the
you
edge.
Start putting, you know, you go from a flat bevel to a
convex.
Angle bevel.
Yeah, convex.
It makes it really tough. And you know, it just doesn't really work.
Yeah. Yeah, that's
pretty much.
It's tricky. Yeah. The bevel geometry, both on the front and back end of a turning hook, I think is, yeah, it's really hard for, you know, for someone who doesn't know metal and doesn't work with metal and doesn't know like edge geometry, I think it's really hard for them to understand, because you can get a hook and that's really good from another maker, and then you can mess that hook up like that just from one sharpening. So like maintaining those angles on the flats, on the backside and the front, I think can be difficult. Yeah. So.
Yeah, I think sharpening can be really intimidating.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Kind of like I was mentioning earlier, there are all these things that I forgot went into the process of getting, like actually turning and getting a bowl on the lathe.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and then sharpening was thrown in the mix, and I was like, wow, it's really incredible that like people that do this have, like, they understand every step of the process.
Absolutely. Yeah. And sharpness on a hook tool is so important, because like when I first started and I was using the Andrew Lloyd hook tools, and I wasn't probably sharpening correctly at all, and you know, I probably messed the bevels up over time. I was noticing that just based on the species of wood I was using and how much moisture it had in it, man, it was getting to be very frustrating, because my hook would snag or it would catch, or I couldn't get it just on the wood at the right angle to be able to get a cut started. And I quickly realized, like, just my bevels were all messed up. And as soon as I started forging my own hooks and making sure, like, the bevels were flat and they were sharp enough, I was like, wow, that's what's been wrong the whole time. Like, duh, you know, like, it's all about that tool. Because as a new pole lathe turner, if your tool is not, like, in good shape, like, it can get frustrating fairly quickly. You're like, this is not working. It's so frustrating. I don't want to do this anymore. So that's one of the things, I think, as a turner, as you start getting into the craft and progress through it, knowing your tool and how it functions and how sharp it is and how to sharpen it and maintain those bevel angles, I think, is so important. And sharpness is so important, because you don't get a good finish unless it's sharp.
Yeah.
Because we're not sanding anything. So, like, and that can make a sale, because if somebody picks up a bowl and it's like, man, this thing is fluffy. Like, why is it like this? You know, I want it smooth. So, and there was, like, and, you know, obviously technique goes a long way too. There was one technique that I learned actually from watching Mark. You're just doing the backside of the bowl. You know, I used to move my hook on and off the bowl just to kind of get that radius going of that curvature that I wanted. And I noticed Mark, when he was turning, he would drag the tool. He would just keep the tool up against the wood and drag and just pick up that little shelf and just take it all the way. And I had turned for, like, I don't know, a year and a half before I realized that. I was like, man, that achieves such a nice, consistent, you know, sweep across the backside. And it's just like subtle things like that. If you don't have the, I don't know, just the innate ability to, like, notice these things and, like, utilize them in your own techniques and whatnot, I think it could really make that transition for you from, like, oh, I'm making a good bowl, oh, I'm making a really nice bowl that I really like looking at, you know, and people enjoy buying and using. So
I think you're exactly right. It's just like all these little changes slowly realize over time.
Yeah,
that's one thing I emphasize a lot, you know. People, they'll have this moment where they're getting really good cuts. It goes away.
Yeah.
And it's just trying to chase that and learn, you know, like, oh, I was holding the tool this way, or applying the pressure in this direction.
Yeah.
And all these little factors that, you know, eventually.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It's a very difficult thing to describe because there's so many planes.
Yes.
Your tools in one plane, your woods in another plane, then it changes as soon as you get to a different part of the bowl. It's very, I find it difficult to put it into words.
Yeah.
Easier to show someone. Because once you, it's all about, for me, it's about feeling. Like, I can feel the tool and how it's interacting with the wood. And like, especially turning nested bowls, it's all about feeling. Like, there's very little visual, there's almost no visual, and there's very little feeling when you touch it. You're just like, sound, it's like there's a bit of an audible aspect to it, what the hook sounds like, and then what does it feel like?
That's so important. That's so important to know, because like there's so many variables at play, and it's the one craft that I've done over the last, I don't know, 5 years since I started crafting, that I realize there's so much involved. There's so much focus and attentiveness. You have to know how your body is, you know, positioned against the lathe. You can't be really tense. You have to position your arm a certain way. You have to have your hook a certain way. The ball has to be, like, there's so many variables at play that I think for the average person who's never done any crafting before, it's like, whoa, this is really overwhelming. And to have them all be like synergistically working together to like get you to where the tool is actually cutting the way you want and you're achieving good results, it's very overwhelming and it's intimidating. Like, I'm sure you've experienced that a lot with your students. That,
absolutely.
You know, getting started, like, God, you know. So yeah, it's really neat. And I think anybody who takes on pole lathing or pole lathe turning or even takes a class, it's like, man, there's so much confidence like that has to go along with it to be able to really enjoy it and feel fulfilled doing it.
Let go of expectations.
Yeah.
And I think that's on both ends.
Right.
Too. Yeah. Especially as a teacher. Yeah.
Struggling, does that mean they're having a bad time?
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, like, their bowl's not turning out super great.
Yeah.
Are they okay with that? And it's like, I think at the end of the day, it's like people are going to be happy with whatever.
Oh, yeah. I still have the first two bowls I turned ever, and I love them. I mean, they're not great bowls by any measure necessarily, but they've held up.
Yeah.
And I can't say that for all my bowls. Even some of my nicest bowls, they've cracked or failed in some way. And these are ones I didn't know what I was doing.
Because they were probably really thick.
They're really thick. They're like tanks.
It's funny you mentioned that, because, like, man, I've been teaching at this place in Lynchburg called Vector Space blacksmithing classes, and I recently taught a camping / grilling fork class, and I had a couple students in my class, and one of them was a sculpturist, and like he worked on clay and he did like clay sculptures. So, and he like just used those skills and that place of creativity to try and apply it to like making something for the first time. He's never forged before, he's never touched the hammer, and, you know, never worked with metal before, and he was like, I'm like, okay, it's time to go home. Like, I need to go. And he's like still working. He's like, I feel rushed. I need to make this perfect. And I was like,
oh God.
Okay. Well, yes, you don't really have to though. But it's really hard, like, having a student come. And then I think the big mistake I made was I brought some examples of ones I made.
Oh yeah.
And it's like, they see that, like, or they study the maker, or they look at their stuff before the class, and it's like, and they think we can teach him how to do that on, like, you know, the 2 or 3 hour block that we're with them. And it's really an unrealistic expectation. And it's sometimes really hard to have a student like that who just cannot get that out of their head. It's like, how do I convey to them that you really have to set this expectation aside and just enjoy the process? Just learn the process first. You'll get there eventually. But it's really hard. It's really hard. And it's like, I almost feel like I carry the burden of them not enjoying the class. Because I'm like, man, I really want you to enjoy this class, because there's so much more to enjoy than just the final piece that you're going to, you know, hang on your whatever or put on the shelf somewhere. So I think as an instructor and a teacher, that's one of the things that I struggle with when I started teaching, is just being able to convey that expectations are really, they're unrealistic for somebody who's first, you know, just getting started with this kind of craft, especially pole lathe turning. I mean, you know, it's so hard getting started as a student. So
it is. Yeah, it is.
Oh my God, yeah, it's the one person orchestra. Absolutely, that's a good way to put it.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, I in a lot of ways I feel like I'm just scratching the surface of like pole lathe turning. Mm-hmm. Like, I think, you know, experimented with nesting a little bit, mm-hmm. but then a few locking lidded boxes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I think that's been a little bit of a challenge of like stepping away from instruction style work or, you know, being more full time a teacher. It's just like having that time to experiment.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, I think, you know, once I'm done,
yeah,
have a little bit more time to experiment.
Yeah.
A lot of things I'd love to try.
Yeah.
Yeah. Same here.
Yeah, and grain.
Same.
Yeah. Yeah, turning some legs for stool.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Oh, that would be neat.
Got a set of Japanese hand planes last year.
Cool.
So much fun to use. Yeah. And like, yeah, shaping.
Mm-hmm.
So it makes it so much more fun.
So much more enjoyable, yeah. Having a good plane.
I wanted to circle back to the topic of green woodworking. You mentioned your impetus of getting into it being kind of moving away from the power tools and all the drawbacks that come with power tools, the loudness, energy they require, so on and so forth. And I always think this is just an interesting aspect of what we call green woodworking, because that's a double entendre. It's green in the sense of like ecological green, as well as green wood. We're using fresh wood, and the tools and techniques that come along with that are appropriate for that material. And I think this is an interesting reason that a lot of people get into this. It's kind of like I think there's a kind of a dichotomy. It's like some people that are motivated for that reason of it being more ecological. Other people, it's just like cool. It's easier to get into because it is green wood. You don't need as many tools. I was just curious about that, like how that's been for you coming into the skills and exploring it from that angle. Like, do you find more joy doing this type of woodwork than you were when you were building the house?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think I really enjoy the accessibility of green woodworking. Shop
right.
or expensive tools. You know, you can have a pretty minimal setup, and that's kind of one thing I struggle with whole lathe turning in particular. Have to build your own.
Yeah, you have to have a lot.
Especially teaching it, you know, I've had a couple of people who have been interested enough to build their own lathes and continue that. You know, I guess I have to consider that as progress.
Yeah.
And a good thing. But
yeah, the fun,
that's okay,
fun thing to try.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I think just the simplicity.
Mm-hmm.
Really peaceful about that.
Yeah.
I think, as I was mentioning earlier, you know, after I graduated college and I hiked the Appalachian Trail, and that really left a big imprint on how easy it is to overcomplicate your life.
Mm.
How simple it can be, and how happy you can be with that simplicity.
Mm.
Found that green woodworking in a lot of ways kind of resurrected some of those feelings that I had.
Yeah, because the AT, it's like simplicity is paramount to your success.
Yeah,
that's great. It is funny. I guess over the past few months, for some reason on YouTube, it keeps showing me different woodworking stuff. And it is kind of funny. Like, if you just watch a video on YouTube, like look up woodworking, you'd think you need to have like $100,000 to get started because these guys have these huge shops. Like, first of all, they got a huge building and it's full of like insane amounts of equipment.
Right.
And they're just making like a table. It's like this little thing, and they're like running through the planer and joiner, and they got the router, and just like, it is, you know, and I'm not going to sit. Like, I have a planer, I have a table saw, I have a chop saw, I've got plenty of power tools. I think they're amazing. But it is very inaccessible if you just want to get into it. Like, you have to drop a couple grand to buy all these tools just to, like, make a board square and flat. Whereas you could buy a saw and a plane for, like, $50 to $100 and do the same thing. But the difference is just the skill level that's required you know, there's skill level required for power tools. It's different. It's a little, I would say it's a lower level of skill that's required. More so like a technical knowledge of the tool and the dangers of it, primarily. How do you avoid the dangers of it? Right. Whereas with green woodworking, like there's so much skill, like the pole lathe, it's so much about skill and knowledge and just like your story in, into it. It's like build the lathe. Okay, now I need an axe. Yeah. Now I need to know how to sharpen an axe. Now I need to know if I have the right type of axe. Like there's so many pieces of skill that are kind of invisible. That's really what separates. I think that's what separates the two. I guess if there's a fork in the woodworking world where you get a power tool or not, not to say that it's black and white. If you were to look at it that way, the separating difference is just the level of skill that's required.
That's a great point, Mark. And to add on to that, I think the difference, I see the main difference between power tools and hand tools is that you don't really get to know the material if you're using power tools.
Because really it just powers through it.
Your power, it's like it's almost like you're just handling the material in a way that's very invasive and you're not really knowing how it works. Because you know, if you're carving a spoon and you go against the grain, you're gonna know fairly quickly.
You find out. Or a plane, or if you're hand planing.
Yeah, or a hand planer, you're gonna know very quickly. But you stick it in a planer, it don't matter which direction you're going, you're still gonna get the finish that you want. So I think just and then same thing, even if you're just exclusively woodworking. You still have to know metal too, because like you got to sharpen the blade.
Mm-hmm.
You got to understand what kind of metal it is and how well it sharpens, right? Like you got to know edge geometry so you know how to your plane works. So like there's so much more to do using hand tools and getting to know the material as well as metal and how the metal interacts with the material.
Because you don't just buy a new circular saw blade or a new planer.
Right. You can't afford a new planer blade every time your planer blade goes bad. You got to sharpen it. You know?
It's very true.
And because of that, you're learning even another skill where you know, you're interacting with metal in a way you have to learn how to sharpen, right? You have to know which shape of, you know, what kind of sharpening method are you going to use? Are you going to use whetstones? Are you going to use, you know, sandpaper? So like, there's so much more that you can learn and grow from using hand tools and exclusively doing that for a while versus just going to Home Depot and buying a plane for $500.
I would argue, this is my experience, it makes you better no matter what tool you use.
Absolutely.
That's my experience.
Yeah. Transferable like, skills.
By learning pole lathe turning, spoon carving, whatever it is, being focused with hand tools, you learn so much about wood and and then you can transfer that knowledge to, then the tool kind of becomes irrelevant.
Like
now you have that skill.
Absolutely.
And so whether you choose to use it, for example, like I was roughing out my plate blanks with a chop saw just because I could it was chainsaw and chop saw so chainsaw them into to square 1 1/4 inch thick blanks and then I'd cut the corners off with the chop saw so I have an octagon and that was just making it so that I could get to the pole lathe a lot faster. So there's things like that too, which is nice. Or using a power drill to drill the hole into the blank if you're using a mandrel, tenon mandrel, things like that. You know, instead of he's getting out the brace and bit. Every bowl takes you, that much. Especially if you're looking at production, having a hybrid where you bring in a power tool to help you, just like what Jared Dahl's done with his Japanese lathe or other makers.
All right, Emmett, the gentleman that works out of. The place in the UK, I forget his name.
Which one?
The one that does end grain cups.
Oh yeah, Yoav.
He's turned. You know, he's totally taken.
Right, but he's taken all of his skill to the power lathe.
To the power lathe,
And you couldn't really tell the difference.
Yeah. No, you can't. And that's I think where it comes. I think you know, as a maker, as you try to transition through these phases, and I love that I can be a part of. You know, the Instagram community and watch some of these makers progress through their craft, like Emmett, Yoav, and Jared, and just saying how, like, they transitioned from, you know, just hand tools and pole lathes into something different. I think from necessity and maybe even feeling the pressure of, like, I got to make a living. Mm-hmm. There's a financial aspect to this craft that, you know, I value because that's what puts food on the table for me. That's what allows me to live a life that I want to live. Feeling that pressure, I think, sometimes pushes us through that to that phase where, maybe hand tool, maybe a bandsaw or a chainsaw would really help save an hour or two in my day to mm-hmm. where I could go spend that with my family or maybe increase my production a little bit and bring in some extra money. I think that's what it comes down to. And I think it's really, for a new maker, they're really missing out on a lot of value and skill that they could learn as they start off, to where they just go right to the power tools mm-hmm. instead of like, oh, let me spend a year or two just experimenting with just hand tools or whatever it is. And then once I've learned that, I can then figure out how to transition to using some power tools. So,
you know, Emmett talks about that with making screen blank.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Practice of it all. But you know, there's always a balance.
Absolutely. You know, there's always a balance.
I was curious, you mentioned doing the markets, you felt like you're trying to keep up with the production, your body started to feel like you're starting to feel, I guess.
Sore.
How do you approach that? Because I remember asking Robin Wood at the course I took with him, someone asked him about that, because he'd been doing it for 25 years or something. And he had an interesting take on it. He was like, at a certain point, you just relax.
Mm.
A lot of the issues that we have with our bodies is from getting tense.
Yes.
And he just said he learned just to relax. And so he didn't have, he said he could turn all day and he felt just as good as he did when he started. And it's because he just relaxed into the process.
Yeah.
And I find that's something I really struggle with when I'm carving or turning, is like I get so fixated on like one little detail that I'm like tensing my whole body, especially on the pole, like hold the tool. And so much about just like relax and let the tool do the work. So have you kind of found any anything like that, any flow that avoid some of those pitfalls?
Yeah, I mean, I try to do a lot of stretching. My body balance, because you know, I think weight bearing on your one leg, that period of time can really kind of throw things out of whack.
For sure.
I think you're exactly right. Where we, the more you do something, you kind of realize all the tension. I think that's a really amazing realization when you're kind of effortlessly moving wood,
because
it's exactly where it's supposed to be. Trying to keep that up, and you know, it doesn't always feel that way. For me, certainly, there's, you know, especially like, you know, doing the core of a bowl, I feel like I've yet to find that to be like an area I can do without holding a little bit.
Yeah,
maybe that's necessary, or maybe my skill is it.
It's certainly a balance. It's certainly a balance.
Yeah. Yeah. In some pretty weird position.
Yeah. It's funny that you guys are talking about this, because I recently started following this guy on Instagram who's a mobility trainer and coach, and who talks about, like, you know, just our mobility as humans and how our body functions and moves, and has, because he used to be like really heavy into weightlifting and strength training and like building muscle and all that, and then he's just kept having injuries, like repetitive injuries, and he's like, what am I doing wrong? So he realized that, you know, our bodies can and should move in a lot of different ways. But what really hurts us the most is just having that repetition. So like being in that position for too long, right? And then being tense in that position for too long is what really does the damage over time. So his approach to it is put your body in all the positions that you can imagine it be going through. And we're supposed to be very fluid and mobile in a lot of ways. But just focus on how tense you are and how long you're staying in that position. So that has really lingered with me for a while now. And every time I find myself in one position where I'm really tense, I'm like, man, gotta relax. You know, and as soon as you think about that and you like just kind of loosen your muscles up a little bit and feel less tension, it's like, oh, I can stay in this longer than I really thought. It's just because I'm so tense right now, you know? And that's so hard to teach someone as a teacher, as an instructor, like when you're trying to teach a student not to be so tense, whether they're using a draw knife or an axe, especially an axe. It's like, you got to throw the axe. What do you mean throw the axe? Like, just loosen your grip. Loosen my grip. What if it falls out of my hand? So you really, even same thing with you know, teaching blacksmithing classes. Everybody comes to the class and they're just so like their elbow stance and they're like hammering with their wrist. I'm like, no, use your shoulder. Loosen up your grip. And it's like so hard to get that out of their head. And I mean, I did it when I first started. So it's just, I think it's just, you feel the need to handle the tool rather than letting the tool do the work for you and just guiding it instead of like doing the work for it, you know? So, but it's a very important, I think, concept to think about and discuss because like as a craft person, you see yourself doing this well into your old age, right? Like you want to be able to enjoy it as much as you can.
Yeah, I hope so.
Yeah.
You know, right. I have no idea at this point in my life. But this is what I'm
doing. Yeah. Yeah. Right. And I think focusing on our bodies and how healthy we can be physically is important because that's what allows us to do these things, you know, and stay fulfilled doing them. Yeah.
Yeah, I guess, yeah, right now my plan is to try to continue to grow a base for teaching craft schools and host private events. Yeah, that's kind of the projection I see. Life throws you curveballs sometimes and yeah, so again, hopefully it'll be up in Maine. Yeah, you know, like I'm really enjoying teaching right now. Like looking forward to some time to kind of grow my own skill. I've kind of been self-taught, you know, with the help of the internet, which is a huge resource. But yeah, I'd really like to take some time to go take class. I've never done. Always been interested in doing, but it's just been a little bit out of my. I think that would be a really great experience.
Just
seeing other people who have really mastered this skill and getting to learn from them. And you know, that might not even be pole turning, you know. There's just so many. I have yet to.
Yeah. That's cool, man. Yeah. 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 Yeah, I'm on that too as well. I haven't taken any classes and I'd love to take something.
Doing it all the time. It looks really great. I just don't know why I haven't done it myself.
Yeah. Yeah. I think for me it was like, oh, that class is $500. Okay. Well, I can buy this new thing that I can use in the shop for $500, you know. So, and I can just watch a YouTube video for 20 minutes and essentially learn the same thing.
That's one thing I'll say that I've been really in awe of within the Greenwood Working. Being able to reach out to somebody and ask them a question and getting like a thorough response.
Yeah.
Like I remember when I was first building my lathe, I like reached out to Owen Thomas. And in my eyes, Owen Thomas was like this pole lathe master, and he absolutely is.
Celebrity.
Hey, like I'm having a little bit of trouble like about getting my centers lined up, and he like responded with this like two paragraph thing, and I was just like, wow, that's like,
yeah,
that's incredible. Yeah. And like, you know, same thing with, I think, reaching out to both of you, you know, both being really, you know, welcoming, saying, yeah, like, let's get together and carve, like fortune. Love the free flow of information.
Yeah.
That's what really makes.
Oh, for sure.
And attractive people.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, Robin, if you're listening, if you're listening, Robin Wood, please. Even if we have to come to the UK and do it in person. Yeah. 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 And we have like several recording devices going. Yeah.
I'm sure there are a lot of things on my mind.
Yeah. That's great. That's great. Yeah. Yeah. You don't know what we're doing. The last 2 years have been just nothing but experimentation. Yeah. Don't forget about our last question. Yeah. You prepared for this one?
I've been thinking about it. You know, I think because I feel so early on in my craft journey and experience, still defining myself. Mm. But I think as of right now, at least, I kind of have this sense that, Sloyd is community. Sloyd is self-sufficiency. Mm. Sloyd is creating something natural through a very
simple. Nice. I like that. Community.
Community. We haven't heard that one before.
Yeah, man.
That's great, man.
Wonderful.
I love that.
Well, without further ado, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Yeah, appreciate it.
Where can people find you if they want to look you up?
So on Instagram, I'm chrisingers.cuts. I've also got a website that's www.chrisingerscuts.com.
Sweet.
The two places I show myself online.
Yeah. I'll throw those links in the description for those who are interested.
Yeah.
But yeah, look Zach up. I almost called you Chris. Look Zach up and
AKA Chris.
We will we'll check in with you guys again hopefully soon.
Hopefully soon.
All right.
Don't hold your breath, but we'll be back.
Sloyd out.